I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Susan Casey joins me now, the best-selling author and writer's book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins, has just been published in softcover. It's a remarkable book that looks at dolphins and the relationship that we have with them. Since the dawn of recorded history, humans have regarded dolphins with reverence for their appearance and intelligence. Yet at the same time, dolphins have been exploited, traded, and killed. You look to recent documentaries like Blackfish and The Cove, and you'll recall the brutality cetaceans encounter. Ms. Casey talks about the mythos of dolphins and her own experience. Susan Casey's previous books include The Wave and The Devil's Teeth. She is the former editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine. She has won many awards for her work, which have appeared in such publications as Esquire, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, Outside, and National Geographic. The website for more is at susancasey.com. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program in Vancouver today, Susan Casey. Ms. Casey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you grew up in Toronto, is that correct?
I did.
Yeah, did you spend much time, because reading up on you and this book and reading about your previous books, you seemed to spend a lot of time in or around the water. What was growing up like for you? Did you spend a lot of time near the water?
I as long as I can remember, I've had this weird fascination with water. And even though I grew up in sort of suburban Toronto, even a swimming pool would sort of do it for me. But we did have a cottage up north, and I remember being in Lake Simcoe and Georgian Bay and Muskoka and all of those places are all good with me.
So what's it like for you if you're traveling, promoting this book, as you are this week and over the last year or so? Did you manage to get time with water? I mean, it seems like you need it, do you?
Oh, yeah. No, I live in Hawaii most of the time, and that's on purpose. I had sort of I left New York, and that was my goal. You know, I figured this was what I wanted most in the world, and I would like to keep writing books to connect people to the mysteries of the ocean and the magic of the ocean. Hawaii seemed like actually sort of an ideal place to do it. And I'd set a couple books there and just it felt like home.
That's the thing. I don't swim. And so for me, when I think of the ocean or water in general, I find it mysterious because it's so big and unknown.
Yeah, and people are scared of the ocean.
Yeah, and so writing about dolphins, do you learn a little bit more about the water than you would otherwise say?
Well, I spent a lot of time reading about science of all kinds in the ocean. Dolphin science and, you know, dolphin everything, dolphin myth, dolphin reality, it's particularly fascinating because along with being stranger than fiction in a lot of ways, that the facts that we know, there's also a great deal of mystery surrounding it.
Yeah, and so you open the book with an experience you had, and it demonstrates why we like dolphins so much, and it's their capacity for intuition. What was going on in your life that you found yourself swimming? I guess this was in Hawaii, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And your interaction with dolphins that particular day.
Well, I was in a state of grief after the death of my father, and hadn't been able to shake it. It wasn't a recent death. Relatively speaking, I guess it was, but it had been more than a year since my father died, and I was in a deep funk that I couldn't get out of. And I was in the water. I had gone over to a part of the island of Maui, pretty far away from where I typically go. And when I got there, it was sort of stormy and gray, and not that appealing. But I was about to get on a red eye to come back to New York, so I thought I was just going to go in the water, and I ended up going for a fairly long swim. I'm a competitive open water swimmer, so it's not unusual for me to go for a long swim, but it was a bit unusual for me to do it alone in sort of darker conditions. But the grief made me feel strangely numb, and in my own personal safety or, you know, but whatever might happen to me, I just didn't care. So I went anyway. And I had, I don't know if you're familiar with my work, but my first book was about this neighborhood of great white sharks, mm-hmm. and I spent a lot of time with sharks. And I've seen a lot of things in the ocean, but I had never had a one-on-one encounter with wild dolphins. And not for lack of being in there, they just never chose to come over to me. I mean, you can't really chase after them in the ocean. They have to be there by their own choice. And that was the night that they chose to come and spend some time with me. And it was a very hypnotic and sort of otherworldly encounter that really captured my attention. And that's what spurred me to start researching them and then to write this book.
And so you think that they have some sort of intuition that they can sense these things. They can sense grief or just a sadness and bring whatever gifts they can to heal, if you will.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think I can ever definitively say they knew this, but it was certainly an unusual timing if they didn't. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I spent a lot of time in the water, and I had never seen them before. You know, was never able to look at them in the eye before. And I think it makes sense in a way because their primary sense is acoustic in the ocean. You know, they're masters of frequency and vibration, and that's really what emotions are. They're frequency and vibration. Everything. If you're standing next to a person who's happy, there's a different vibe around them than a person who's, you know, really sad. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how they discern these very subtle things about us.
And they are quite popular compared to other, say, cetaceans like sharks, for example. Is there a way of knowing how they like us, say, as humans?
I think dolphins are an awful lot like us in that they have moods, they have quirks, they're individuals. We know they're self-aware. We know they have names. And so my answer to that would be, I think some of them might like us on some days. In the same way that, you know, you don't always feel like having a million people around you, or you might like some people better than others. Or, you know, I think there's quite a lot of variation. I don't think you can use the term dolphins very homogeneously because they are just all unique, distinct individuals.
Do they have sex with other creatures?
Besides dolphins?
Besides themselves, yeah.
Well, they're very physical. There's rumors of human dolphin sex.
That in the book, do you not?
Really say that was any widespread sort of deal, but in captivity, sometimes dolphins will get frustrated and try to express their aggression or anxiety or, you know, whatever it is. There have been some instances of them trying to have sex with other creatures. Yeah, and there have been also cross-species dolphin progeny. Like, there's an animal called a wholefin, which is a part false killer whale, which is one of the bigger dolphin species, and part bottlenose dolphin. Hmm. Most of the time, those offspring won't survive, but sometimes they do.
Yeah, so there's a story in the book about one of the women who was part of a study by this doctor, a real odd fellow named John Lilly, back in the 50s and 60s. He studied LSD, and then he did some work researching dolphins. And what were you able to find out in terms of just the relationship between that woman who lived with a dolphin, if you will? I guess it was in a sort of house that was flooded, right? Or half flooded?
Yeah. So John Lilly was a neuroscientist in the 50s and 60s, and he became very influential in terms of how we looked at dolphins and whales, because he was looking at their brains during the Cold War. And he, you know, in the 50s and 60s, people didn't know anything about dolphins at all, and they thought, hey, it's a big fish. And, of course, it's not a fish at all. It's a mammal, and they have these massive brains. So when John Lilly took a look at the dolphin brain, he had very little interest in going back to working with monkey brains or cat brains or rat brains, which is, you know, what he was studying in his neuroscience lab before that. He became very enamored with dolphins and started making all these pronouncements about them being our elders in the universe. And he hooked up with Carl Sagan, and they tried to use dolphins to crack the code of communication. Like, if aliens landed, we could use dolphins to practice. And then Lilly got a bunch of money from all of these government agencies and created a research lab in the Virgin Islands, which was very, very, it's almost surreal how cool this place looked. And so it's Lilly and his dolphins, and, as you said, all these flooded, half-flooded buildings, and all these beautiful women standing around in bikinis. And they were trying to teach dolphins to speak English so that they could tell us the secrets of the universe. Mm. And one of the experiments that they did was to have a woman, her name was Margaret Howe, live in a partially flooded house with a young male bottlenose dolphin named Peter, and so they would be living in 2 feet of salt water. The dolphin could swim, the human could kind of slosh around, and the idea was that Margaret would teach Peter English in the same way that like a human baby would be taught culturally and socially to speak. And so they had language lessons, manners, pronunciation, all sorts of things. It was a very audacious and weird experiment, and it went off the rails pretty quickly because Peter did have feelings for Margaret, but they weren't like a sort of a parent-child type deal.
Right, right. And then so you look at some of her, I guess, notes or her diaries, if you will, and there's nothing definitive in terms of a relationship. Well, I guess there is a sort of relationship, but whether it's physical or not, were you able to determine anything?
Oh, it's pretty explicit, yeah.
Yeah, and so what is it, I guess, because you also look at their brains, and dolphins' brains are just so fascinating to think. I mean, there's a line in the book about how developed they are compared to say, our brains.
Well, their brains, yeah. Dolphins have this really cool evolutionary path, and it's very ancient. They started off their life on this planet on land 100 million years ago, and the way they looked, it was described to me as like sort of small hoofed wolves. And then they moved into the water over the course of about 20 million years and became large predators with really big teeth. It almost kind of looked a little bit like those swimming dinosaurs that you see in pictures. And they didn't have particularly huge brains. But then at some point around 55 million, about 35 million years ago, everything changed for them yet again. And their bodies became smaller and their brains became bigger and their teeth became smaller. They developed high-frequency hearing, this biological sonar that they have, and then they became social animals. And so they began to really move in groups as opposed to, like, solitary predators. So they've had these massive shape-shifting changes, but the brain that they have now is about 35 million years old, and ours is about, so let's just, I'm going to be generous here and say 500,000, somewhere between 200,000 and 500,000 years old. So their brain is far more ancient than ours.
Hmm. And then there's a photograph of it, and it just looks complex and complicated.
Yeah.
And suggests just how, I guess,
it's
brilliant.
Bigger. Yeah.
How brilliant the minds are. Another fascinating person you talked to in the book is Rick O'Berry, who a lot of us, I guess, came to know because of the movie The Cove. Where does a guy like him see the fight over dolphins in captivity today? I mean, is it a much brighter future for dolphins than it was, say, 10 years ago?
I think in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. And, I mean, Rick's big saying is, I'm going to keep doing this until they stop or I drop. And so even though I think you can see signs of public shifts in public awareness and public consciousness about what it means to put an animal this intelligent and this social into the swimming pool here in North America, in other parts of the world, there's no such awakening happening. Like one of the places where the Cove, they still export a lot of dolphins, and that's live dolphins, and that's really the economic underpinning of the hunt. If there was no market for captive dolphins, they probably wouldn't continue that hunt. And those dolphins go to China, they go to Japan, they go to Russia, the Middle East, all over the Caribbean. There's a huge appetite to get live dolphins in these Swim with Dolphins programs that spring up in pretty grotty pools near where cruise ships disembark, because these people will pour off a cruise ship and pay $100, you know, to swim with the dolphin and not think anything of it. But, of course, Rick's line is, it, you know, costs you $100, it costs the dolphin his life.
Yeah. And movies like The Cove, like Blackfish, they have raised awareness, but I guess activists like Rick, they're facing these industries, aren't they? And so what can the regular person do, if you will, in terms of, changing things? I mean, what do you suggest in the book?
Well, I have lots of resources in the book for websites and organizations that you can get involved with or contribute to in some way. And also, I think the big one is don't go to marine parks.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I don't, it's not a blanket assertion, because there are a couple of marine parks that are actually caring for dolphins that have been injured. Like the Baltimore Aquarium is now, they haven't done a stupid dolphin show for a long time. They are trying to evolve their relationship with dolphins, and they basically are doing, they have the intention of teaching people real natural history about dolphins and eventually funding the development of a sea pen kind of retirement sanctuary for dolphins that have been in marine parks. because keep in mind that even if we stopped all dolphin captivity today, we would still be looking after captive dolphins for a long time because we've bred a bunch of them in captivity, yeah. And those dolphins can't really just be released back into the ocean because they've never really learned how to be wild dolphins.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to be stewards of them. We just can do a lot better job. But yeah, don't go to the exploitative marine parks. And if you want to swim with dolphins, do it in the wild or go in a whale watching boat. Or, you know, there's no guarantee that it will happen, but you certainly learn a lot more about the ocean, the creatures that live in it by going into the ocean.
Yeah, one of the ways that humans are harming dolphins, and it has to do with sonar. And I didn't really think about this until I read the book about just how harmful, the noise that's going on underneath the water is harmful to a creature like the dolphin.
Very much, because, yeah, their hearing is so highly, highly developed. I mean, we're primarily visual creatures, and if somebody, let's say, was shining a blinding light into your eyes all day long, you'd go crazy pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And noise in particular is like excess noise is, it's an actual physical force, and it's very harmful. You know, if you've ever been in a situation where you're exposed to unduly loud noises, you know how stressful it is, and the ocean has become a very noisy place, and in fact so noisy that it's created like chronic stress in dolphins, which, you know, really affects their health and in some cases outright killed them.
And the other thing that's in the book is that the U.S. Navy have started using dolphins, is that right?
They have done that for a long time. They have been doing it since the 50s or 60s. There's I forget how many dolphin troops. It's not that many anymore. I want to say like 80.
Yeah.
But they are, according to the Navy, primarily used to clear underwater land, to look for underwater landmines or marauding frogmen underwater where U.S. ships are docked and things like that.
Yeah. What's your next book, Susan?
I think it will be something in the ocean, but yeah. I don't exactly know what that is yet. It takes a while to figure it out.
Well, this is such a fascinating book, and I mean, they are fascinating creatures to begin with, but it's written so well that it just whizzed through it. Congratulations and continued good luck with the book, Susan. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
SusanCasey.com is the website. The book is called Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Susan Casey, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.